We are open to the conversation about forgiving self because it's sort of a continuous conversation. I'm reminded as I dealt with forgiveness about the old piece I heard back in Texas about the Baptist pastor that was asked by his friend who was a priest to sit in for confession because he had to leave town. And he said, I've never done it before. Baptist pastor said, so I'll just listen two or three times. Sure enough, did you do it once? Did you do it twice? It was do it three times. Well, then pray so many Hail Marys and make this kind of offering. That went fine. The priest left. He's doing well. Second person comes in. Did you do it once? He said, yes. Did you do it twice? He said, yes. Did you do it three times? No. He wasn't sure what to do then. So he said, well, I'll tell you what. Go out and do it again. So... If you have something in mind, we shall see. I'm going to try to follow without distracting you too much, just enough to start conversations on the outline you have under forgiving others. That, again, is what I've collected over several years in terms of what I've heard and learned and read. Why do we struggle with our willingness to forgive? Because, first of all, we want someone identifiably to take responsibility for the harm or hurt they've caused, and we're waiting, hoping that they will, speaking of confession, or at least acknowledge. That's one. Under number two, I think sometimes I've heard people say, I just wanted the person to understand the degree of pain they caused. I don't think they have fathomed the degree of the hurt. And so they're waiting at some point on some awareness of the kind of injury and its identification, a little different than one. Under the third conversation, there are times people are struggling to forgive in suspended animation, as I call it, because the one who they would need to forgive is no longer available. They have either passed away, or they're out of connection, or somehow in the process they are unavailable for one kind of care or another. By the way, our seminary has had a relationship with restorative justice, where we engage in a conversation, prisoners who sit down with the victim and spend time talking about the injury, the process of recovery and reparation, and they take responsibility not only for what they did, but the victim decides to make a set of decisions about to what degree they will respond and in what way. The Center for Restorative Justice has been going on now for about 7 or 8 years. I'm on that board, but a couple of people have been very instrumental in making sure that that takes place. And so we go to prison systems. They go more than I do. Under number four, sometimes knowing there is a process, it's too tender, too raw, and it's just an amount of injury and pain that they just don't want to release the offender. It's one form, perhaps, of saying, I want you to hurt some like I hurt, or I want at least for us to take seriously the intensity of the injury or harm. That goes with number five, where some people want to see some suffering because they suffered. Under number six, we struggle with whether offering forgiveness actually takes the debt too lightly or betrays a cause or a person, because sometimes we're looking at what someone else did, third-party kind of conversation, and we wonder if that does justice to the significance of the of the injury or pain. There's some major myths, and under number seven, I've identified the idea that withholding forgiveness only harms the offender. And that's probably one of the most important questions for you and I to retain as we walk through the hour, the time together today. There is a misunderstanding between offender and offendee that the only one who is suffering from the pain is the offender. We carry the energy, the pain, the difficulty of not offending. That's why Jesus Christ was working hard on trying to communicate about forgiveness. It's to release the person who has been offended, not just the one who somewhere in the process was the offender. I think under number eight, I suggested last week that a number of people struggle in the issue of the movement toward forgiveness because they misunderstand, as I interpret it, that to forgive someone is to restore them to the same level of trust they had before, when that is not what I believe forgiveness involves, because there are some people who are not capable of the level of trust they had before. We can trust them, but some space and boundary is appropriate. But some people are so afraid they have to return to that vulnerability, and so they struggle with whether they can forgive. And of course, under number nine, there are some people who actually believe that forgiving is a form of weakness. And you'll hear me saying that the presuppositions that it's actually a form of strength. You're remembering particular issues in the Bible, I'm sure, probably the most significant of which is when he looks down from the cross and says, "Forgive them, for they know not what they do." So, if those are somewhat clear and you could add to them, I'm sure, I'll just mention some presuppositions that shape biblical forgiveness as far as I'm concerned. And these are part of my understanding and interpretation, so feel free to enter the conversation. One of our greatest struggles is the perception that retaliation satisfies. It doesn't satisfy. It multiplies the injury and the alienation. And I think people who are not accustomed even to retaliation find themselves out of their comfort zone if that's what they're looking for. That's been a struggle as I've sat with families who've lost a loved one. The last 2 years in a row, I've been in Richmond, where the chaplaincy and the city program have brought together victims who've lost a teenager by homicide, and some of the struggle they have with what they want to do with that and how to process it is unfinished business. Because at first, the anger, as part of their care, means they want to strike back, but then the struggle they have is whether that ever satisfies. And so that's an assumption I think Christ was also challenging. Retaliation does not satisfy. Under number two, I've already mentioned, there is the misperception that unresolved forgiveness only injures the offender, not the person who carries the pain and the injury of the unfinished conversation. Under number three, my assumption is that forgiveness involves a process of taking anger, pain, even the rage and sorrow that's involved in an injury quite seriously. It doesn't mean bypassing it. But some people are afraid. I still remember when my four-year-old older brother and I had our differences, that they were resolved physically. Somewhere in the process, I remember when my mother would say, you know, make up. She didn't say kiss and make up. But I still remember I'm saying, I'm sorry, when I really weren't. There's a process, and to deal with taking the injury seriously and the emotions that are behind it is very important. So that means what number four is trying to interpret. Forgiveness is a process, not just an act of the will. It's not just saying the words. It's moving through the experience of very significant emotional trauma. Injury, a sense of betrayal, pain, you know, a variety of different feelings. It does take time. Under number five, you heard me say, it is an expression of strength, and it is a gift to others when people can take the initiative in the conversation. In the next room, processing forgiveness creates an experience of freedom, not control. And here I'll pause a second to interpret what I've often heard. I would forgive her if she would just acknowledge what she did. Well, guess who's trapped? The person who is waiting for an acknowledgement that may never come. That's part of what Christ was trying to say. We imprison ourselves and are controlled by when we surrender the power on the forgiveness dialogue to someone who has to acknowledge it. And if you, I'm sure you know it, but I'll just say it. There are some people who cannot acknowledge it. There are some people who will not acknowledge it. But you and I are not following the lead of another behavior. We're following the lead of someone who has taught us that the healing piece is to set ourselves free from being conditioned by someone's capacity to acknowledge the pain they've caused. I hope that's clear to you. It's part of what I think forgiving others does involve. If I have to wait on someone understanding or acknowledging, I could wait the rest of my life, right? That's why 7 is there. Somewhere taking initiative is the beginning on the journey, which is critical to any reconciliation and to the issue of forgiveness. That is why I think Jesus Christ declared that he was forgiving those who didn't understand all that they were doing, and even those who did understand. It is a gift of releasing. There are steps to forgiveness, but you and I can go there next. I thought I'd pause here to see if, to some degree, these make sense to you, if there are questions or comments or something you would like to add. Some of you have been around here. A long time ago, I mentioned when our daughter always waited in the car when I was pastor to drive away and go home with me. At the ripe age of 8, she waited in the car. I got in the car. The last one's there, as usual. You know? And she sighed as we drove out of the parking lot and said, "Dad, today you were really boring." You need to know how to take it positively. I'm saying, you know, I usually am boring, but I excelled this particular day. So. I'm looking out at your eyeballs to see if you're still there.
Dan.
Yeah.
I've been intrigued by the idea, and I guess I've had maybe some conflicting thoughts on it. Is it only the wounded party that can offer forgiveness, or can we offer forgiveness on behalf of, or is that not our place? As I read, you know, the New Testament, if you forgive the sins of any, they are forgiven. That almost indicates perhaps a responsibility even to share forgiveness, maybe even if you weren't the one wounded, but it still doesn't feel like the most natural or right. My thoughts really aren't that
No, it's fine, but it's clear, I think.
I'm intrigued by that.
Did you understand the comment or the question? On the individual basis, there's a group of psychologists who speak of gestalt psychology, and what they do is identify the deceased person in a chair in front of the person who is needing to forgive and struggling with an unfinished dialogue, and they have them start the dialogue so that the absent chair takes the place at the beginning of the conversation, because they can say what they believe, what they thought, and how they felt. And then in the absence of a response, the psychologist, speaking on behalf of, pronounces that person not only having acknowledged the pain, but the person absent as having understood it and accepting the need to confess it. That doesn't always work, but it is what some people do, particularly with the absent third person, you know. Individual to communal, over the years I've worked with, I think I mentioned to you last time, alienated church members who somehow felt they were unjustly or at some point offended by the congregation. And I have taken it upon myself as pastor or representing the church to say, On behalf of the church, I want to apologize for whatever way we neglected you or failed you. And then I will pause and say, at some point, is there a possibility that there can be reparation so that you, who now have the power, can decide whether you can still reconnect with us or if you need to find another family of faith? I'm speaking for a group. And you and I know that communally in terms of how we've struggled lately with the issue of racism, the inheritance of injustice, and where we can speak as a community in regard to the past. It's an intriguing piece, isn't it? There are people also who cannot word it, and so I have sat with people who had the need to say it but didn't know how to say it and didn't know if they had the courage to say it to someone. So I've sat beside them while it was being said. Those are the things that come to mind when you mention what you did. Are we on that?
Yeah, that's helpful because, on the one hand, I could see how someone could say, I was the wounded person. You had no right to forgive.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I hear you saying in some of these circumstances, that may be the only forgiveness that comes. And so if we err, I suspect we want to err on the side of offering that forgiveness in whatever way we can attempt to repair relationship, even if we're on the periphery of it, seems like it's what we ought to do.
In that conversation, sometimes one or two of the comments that I raise is, what would it take for you to forgive your mother? What would you require of your brother in order for? And so I'm trying to help them listen to what they have called the impediment or the removal of it. And sometimes they can't. And when they come to where they can't, my tendency pastorally has been to say, well, I want to keep in touch with you to see if that ever changes. You have the right to hold on to it. I don't know if you know that holding on to it causes you pain and requires energy. So I'm trying to say to them, you would do yourself a gift.
Yes,
you know?
Yes.
But it's still their right to decide when. I think everybody has sense. To. Does that make some sense?
Absolutely.
Good question. Scott?
Yeah, following up on that. This has kind of nagged at me forever. At what point, to some degree, it seems like forgiveness is simply a practical thing. It makes us better. But is there something deeper that we should do? I'm thinking of Daniel's little anecdote a couple of weeks ago with the two boys who were misbehaving, and the mother said, well, what would Jesus do? And one of the boys said to the other, well, this time you be Jesus. Well, it's like, better to give than to receive. Okay, I'll let you give. I'll receive. I mean, there's a practical thing to forgiveness. But is there something deeper? I mean, I hear so often, I mean, when Bill was talking about the hard sayings of Jesus and turning the other cheek, I remember one of the commentaries said that, there's something about the left hand and the right hand and the palm and the back hand. I know the Bible discriminates against left hand, but that's not the story. I forget. But I can't even remember how that worked. But the point was, well, if you turn the other cheek, was it Paul who said it would heap coals on them if you do this? Maybe I shouldn't forgive because I sure don't want those coals on somebody else. I mean, how do you separate the practicality, almost the selfishness, and the altruism?
Could you hear that all right? The question of how do you separate and when do you speak of altruism versus the practicality side of it. My sense from the issue of the Christian life is that I can only work for myself and respond for myself. Someone else has to decide how they will act. So my responsibility as a Christian, I think, greater than someone who's not, if you're hearing me say it now, is that I must take the initiative. Because I may be the one who can, the one who's not paralyzed, the one who is not immobilized in some form or other. And so I take responsibility for the initiative. How they respond and whether they do is theirs to decide. Because there are some places where some people, and I think this is what Paul was referring to, I'm interpreting obviously, there are places where people don't plan to respond and want to hold it against us. They then have to deal with their particular pain and their particular consequences. Am I talking about what you're... I know it's a fuzzy piece, but it is... I think I need to take initiative in a relationship. If I wait for someone who offended me, there are some people who don't even know they offended us, right? And there are others who did and who do and really don't know what to do about it, right? And so there are several categories there. So if I feel offended, I need to start the conversation from my perspective so that we can clear it up, which practically speaking, hopefully is an invitation for that person to be reduced in their pain and my being reduced, my having my pain reduced also. But I don't it's not guaranteed, right? There are some people who want to have the power of offending and keeping people unhappy. I think those were the people Paul said, you know, let them deal with the pain on the colds on their head. But we have the responsibility of trying to break down the wall of partition as Christ did. Because what I learned from the God who starts in creation is that God is always initiating first, and that Jesus Christ came to initiate. I keep on putting up walls, and God keeps starting conversations, the most eloquent of which is Bethlehem. He comes as a human being, I understand, and says, let's get this going again, and tries to help me understand that it is not separation from a relationship that God wants, but reconciliation. You want to say more about that? You okay for that?
what I heard you say,
yeah,
is that Christians have a greater responsibility to forgive than anyone else. Is it different?
Yes, you heard me say that. Not me, but you. No. I mean everybody. I think so. I think into whom much is given, to me that interprets a sense of insight and a sense of responsibility, my perception.
Okay. I was thinking how powerful it was when those parents, within 24 hours, said that they forgave this fellow who came in and shot their children and killed a number of them. And nobody else could do that. They were the only ones who could pronounce that forgiveness. And I know there were people who said, well, they shouldn't have done that. That was too quick. That was too easy. But how powerful that was, and what that says about Christians taking a position of, I am the only one who, in this case, can initiate forgiveness, and I choose to do so.
And my sense of that is that that grew out of an ongoing experience of how they saw their relationship to God and everything who would be. It wasn't something they just decided that day, was it? You know. And so it's a cultivation of an attitude, I think, which makes a difference. Some people would read that as weakness or not taking the crime seriously, wouldn't they? You're right. Other comments on where we are? Yes, Jean.
Tell me what forgiveness really means. Define it other than the word forgiveness. Does it include this? Does it not include that? I struggle with that word.
Understood. Thank you. Is there another question? There's a little book on one of these, by the way, by Smeads that helps me because I've been saying it a while, but it was better put by him. It does not mean forgetting an injury. To forget an injury is not to take it seriously either. It is not holding that injury against someone in a relationship. So that to forgive is to give. There's that word in the middle, you know. To give someone the privilege of still having a relationship even though they have erred, marred, or caused injury so that it does not impede some relationship. That's a start. Is that a start?
Yeah.
Okay.
If you spend time listening to the stories you hear, forgiveness takes every formal, okay, I forgive you, to what Bert's talking about.
Yes.
And there's such a range of feeling that either is or isn't there when the person says that. Mm-hmm. It makes it difficult for me to wrap my arms around really
yes.
what is being said and what is being felt.
Of course. No, it makes sense. And you know the word theologically is grace. And that is why when you and I experience someone not placing what we have done to harm them between them and us, that we experience a new sense of love and care. And that's what God was doing in Jesus Christ, I think. So grace is the word. And as you know, it's too easily used. And unfortunately, just like forgiveness, it can be very superficial. Some of you, I think, remember a couple of years ago I mentioned that he's passed away, a pastoral counselor in Kansas City, Missouri, wrote a book called Grace is Not a Blue-Eyed Blonde. And he was talking about the significance and the import of the experience of being forgiven for being myself, being forgiven for the acts I have performed and things I have not done also. Thank you for the question, though, because, yes, Emily.
A few years ago, I heard a television program, and a woman was being interviewed, and she had something horrible happen in her life. I've even forgotten what it was. But at the end of the interview, the person said to her, "Do you think you could forgive this person or persons?" And the woman paused and didn't say anything for a while, and she said, "I think I have begun to walk the path of forgiveness." And I thought that was huge. Mm-hmm. That she didn't blurt at it quickly, but it shows that that is a process and that she was beginning the process. That stuck in my mind and it made me think. I had another friend in a church many years ago, we were much younger, and she had a terrible thing happen to her. And she said to a group of us in the church, "You know, we've been taught our lives as Christians, we should forgive. And when you say, 'I forgive,' quickly, because you think that's what you ought to do, you have to realize that maybe you haven't been really forgiven within your heart and your emotions. You do it with your lips because you think that gets you off the hook and you've done it. But have you really forgiven in your heart?" Those two things have stuck with me.
And I think very appropriate. I sometimes sit in class or in church, forgiveness is a percentage issue, and it keeps increasing, hopefully, if we keep working on it, because I think it's related to our healing process. I am not completely connected. You spoke of your heart. I'm not completely connected to forgiving as long as the woundedness is so intense. And so that's why I think it's like a process of healing. It takes some time to be a reality. And I didn't mean to be shallow about a percentage basis. I think it just keeps going on for a while. Good word. Yeah. Yes, Dean.
What about flipping the script a little bit here? And what about seeking forgiveness? I know there's no prescription for when, but the scripture tells us before you go to the table, you hurt someone, seek their so. What's the process in order to do that? I mean, you know,
how do we initiate, or
how do you initiate as the offender going to the one that you have offended?
Yeah, and I think both of these, the offended and the offender, require courage to start a conversation. But I think that is part of the invitation that we are to provide. So at some point we gain enough courage, because the fear is that we will be rejected. Isn't that there? In my head it is. So I take initiative and I ask for permission to sit down and take someone seriously. That may begin by writing a note first in some cases. That sometimes I have noted has helped some people who are not sure of what they want to say and don't want to be right in the face and not have the words they want and not be able to express how they feel. as long as they follow it up. So I suggest that sometimes for people who struggle with the words. And also on the offended side, I've heard people say, I don't want to meet with Dean. I don't know what he's going to say, you know. So there's a vulnerability. It's personal. The vulnerability is on both sides, but there are some people who are afraid you're just going to come and give excuses, and I want you to take me seriously. So I think somehow being clear is helpful. Sometimes that's done by word. If I can very clearly say, Dina, I'm coming to see you. There's some things I have been harboring that are on my mind. I've not been fair to you. I have failed you. And I need to say that. Can we have some time together? So that I also don't slide it off in a one-minute conversation, right? Is that a start?
Yeah, there's also timing issues involved. It
requires some privacy. That's why somewhere along the way, Roman Catholics came up with a booth and wanted it to be more private and wanted people to be able to speak and say something back, you know? And that's why people like Daniel and sometimes like Bert, no, Bill, that's where a third party representing God can sometimes speak the words, because that is another issue on the question you had, you know. Because there are some people who might say, I can't do this now. I don't think I can forgive. And if we try it two or three times, that's the next place in peace. I think if we leave the invitation open, at some point we decide how long and under what circumstances, but at some point in a different description of shaking the dust off your sandals, there is a place where you move on, because they won't. That's not initially or quickly. Is that? Thanks. Dean and I have had trouble before, so that's.
I'll see you after.
Okay. Yes, Peggy.
Ed and I joined River Road Church. Mm-hmm. March the 11th, 1969, before we got married. And I have seen so many members, church members, that have moved on, that have left our church. And it's hurt me, because I know they were hurt. And I've reached out to a lot, because I've missed them. I've really missed our church family. Sometimes they will share and sometimes they won't, but they have been offended. And so all that, like you said, you can do is just to tell how sorry that we are and invite them back, but they have not come back. And I can tell you that I have reached out to 10 and 15 families that I really miss, and I just hope that this will help us to remember, as we're engaging in conversations and whatever we're doing, that we need to be very careful.
And part of what you're saying relates to Daniel's question in the beginning, and that is, can a third party make a difference by being a witness? You come to someone and say, I'm present here and I want to hear your story of, you know, disconnection or injury. That may be all we do, but I think that's sacred also, because it's a conversation in the presence of God in that regard. There are some people who are not willing to do that and not ready. There is the fear of rejection in that conversation too, and so that, you know, I think that's another factor that's sometimes at work. And misperceptions about what it means and what is involved. But I think I mentioned last week there's another factor maybe we haven't said today, and that is, dealing with differences in any relationship involves some degree of conflict and conflict resolution. We have very poor models, often in our families, for how to resolve a conflict so that it doesn't break a relationship or distort it to the place where it is immeasurably damaged. It's too bad. And so I think we need to do better conflict resolution in our families and in our churches. And I'm not saying that with ease, because I think that takes work and care, and it involves some vulnerability, and so it's not all the time for everybody, but I do think it's an issue in all of that. there are some people who are so conflict avoidant because every experience they've had has been a broken relationship. Now, here's the sad part of it. So in order not to deal with that kind of conflict, they have a cutoff relationship. Family Systems calls it cutoff. And that means they just don't talk anymore with that particular person, which of course continues damage from another side. But it is less, they believe, it is less disturbing than dealing with the conflict. Does, you know what I'm trying to say?
I recently heard some survivors of mass shootings that committed suicide because they could not forgive themselves for surviving. And I hope we never, ever have to deal with that. But self-forgiveness.
You're mentioning about students who took their own lives because they couldn't forgive themselves after feeling that they had failed. And you've been reading that even recently because a father, you know, up from the Northeast, took his own life after his children. This was a year. Oh, goodness. Time goes by, doesn't it? And then down in Florida, we've had a classmate or two that took their own life because we call it survivor guilt. And the struggle with what could I have done and why was I saved and the various conversations people have in their heads. And that's where keeping in touch with caring community makes such a difference. We okay? I was going to give a test on this at 7, but we haven't. You've been doing a much better job than I had under steps in forgiveness. So you see them there, and if there's a question about it, we can pick up on one or two pieces before we disband for the evening. Acknowledging is very important. It's impressive how many people go through life with multi experiences of grief and loss and injury, never acknowledging them to someone else and even to themselves. And the weight that involves. That is why, again, the issue of worship is so important, because sometimes in a prayer, in an anthem, in a sermon, in a variety of different places in worship, hopefully we're getting in touch with the unfinished weight in our lives. Expressing the pain, anger, and sorrow in some way, I think, is useful and helpful. Next time, it won't be next week, but the following week, we'll talk about being angry with God in terms of the struggle that people have with one who is omnipotent and could make a difference, even though we feel defenseless or incapable and inadequate. How do you deal with that? But somewhere along the way, part of forgiving someone else is letting go of the injury so that it does not become an enemy to ourselves. It's the willingness to let go. And as you know, some people have a need to hold on to it. And that's our greatest, probably, challenge on the issue of forgiving someone else. We call it secondary gratification in psychology. That somewhere along the way, and I think I mentioned this last time in terms of some folks who've left the church, and I don't mean this one, but along the way, who have found a way to be inactive and to be disconnected, and they don't want to change that, so they don't want to deal, you know, with where it is. You remember that, and I still am impressed when I read it over again. When Jesus Christ asked this man who's been 38 years by this pool and he can't get in, or at least it doesn't seem he can get in, do you want to be healed? He's saying, I've been sitting here for 38 years, and you're asking, I think he'd try to swat him if he could, you know. But you know what he was touching on. He was dealing with the reality that sometimes in our handicaps or our struggles, we become so accustomed to the injury we hold that we don't want to trade it. And so there's some relationships where we find it more attractive, I hate to say that word, to maintain the distance than to do the work of getting into the waters. That does involve a redefining of relationship, and I think that's part of the work that sometimes people haven't thought about, and so you can think about that. I think we're regularly redefining relationships in terms of closeness and distance, in terms of vulnerability, in terms of trust along the way. And sometimes it may help for us to sit down and talk about where that is with somebody or the places where it's been somehow affected, for what it's worth. And you already know and have said, it is an individual journey, and different people, given the emotional history of their life, will do it different ways. There's no wrong or right way. But I do think it takes a while. You have been patient so far. Does anyone have another question or a good benediction?
Well, I listened to Peggy talk about folks who left and relationships broken. Brought in a situation to mind, and I don't know if it's useful to tell. You can let me know after I've told it.
But all of you leave the room.
The first pastor of our church, Dr. David Earl Brown, 1947 to 1950, I think. You didn't hear his name mentioned. He wasn't celebrated. He wasn't invited to come around. And when Peggy and I joined, I was curious about that because he and his wife were good friends with my parents. And I was aware he'd been the first pastor of this church. But when I brought his name up, people just hushed. And so I inquired with my parents, you know, what's that about? You know, in the absence of accurate information, people have a tendency to wonder and make up stuff. He was asked to leave the church. It was a very painful thing, particularly for the church officers who had to do that. What happened was he spent more money than he made. And it was a problem, and it was a recurring problem. And local merchants would call the church about debts. And when he was not able to resolve that, there was a separation. Well, at our 50th anniversary, he marched down the aisle, white hair, 80-some years old. His family was here. Two of the four sons were still alive. It was a moment of healing. But it took a long time. And I don't think folks ever really know what the problem was, but maybe that can be told. And if there was any curiosity as to what else it might have been, you know, people speculate over all kinds of stuff. So his portrait is in the reception room right along with all of our other beloved pastors, and it just feels good to be able to speak his name.
Janet knows when I was pastor at 7th and James for a number of years, by the 6th or 7th year, I started with the group of, you know, with the deacons to invite former pastors to come in for a celebratory history of the church. And by the second time I started the conversation, two deacons took me aside and said, all of these are okay, but don't invite this one. They meant well, because part of what they're saying is we still haven't healed for something back there, you know.
Did you invite him?
It was I. No. Yes, we did. We did. Yeah. And what's interesting, in there are three invitations he refused, and finally he came on a fourth one, you know, but it took time. But we also had to have a conversation in the church. What does this mean, and how do we deal with it? Are we then saying it didn't matter, things that they were remembering? And like, so. You have been kind. Is this where I take an offering? I forget.
Yes.
That's right. As Wally Criswell used to say in Dallas, just pass your wallets down the aisle.
Thank you, Dan. I have enjoyed these. Enjoy is not the word. I've been moved by our conversation. We all can share testimony of times that we have been grieved, and we knew we needed to forgive, and it took us a while to get there. And, but lest we consider ourselves too self-righteous, we know we've been on the other side of that too. And when we consider how often that we have been forgiven, it's awfully hard for us to withhold that from someone else. Some of the harshest words in the New Testament, for my money, and Bill, right now, I don't remember if you dealt with this in your book, but the story Jesus tells of the master who forgives the debts for the man, and then he goes around and tries to collect his debts and it will not forgive. The way that master lets that worker have it is, for my money, I mean, you almost feel bad even listening in on it. But I think I heard that, you know, that to whom much has been given, much is required. I know I have been forgiven over and over and over again, and I hope I can be generous with those times of forgiveness as well. One thing clicked for me tonight, and I'll just share this, if this is helpful or not. I was going to ask, but I used up my question at the beginning. I'm particularly struck by the forgiveness does not equal weakness, but can equal strength. And I remember, this has been probably 4 or 5 months ago, in my office with someone, and she said, I finally was able to forgive. I said, what was it that made that change? And she said, I realized I deserve to live better than this. That's it. It's not saying, okay, just roll over and play dead, let bygones be bygones, as we sometimes put it. It's, I cannot carry this anymore. I deserve to live better than this. And that clicked for me as a way that we can reassert our humanity and our personhood. And I think forgiveness also does the same for the other person. To say, no longer count this against you. We may not be like we were, but it doesn't have to be like this. So, the challenge before us, I think, is simply this. Forgive as freely as God has forgiven you. Go in peace. Thank you. Good night.